Hey everyone, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. My guest today, Derek Fisher, five times an NBA champion as a member of the Los Angeles Lakers, but more recently the head coach of the New York Knicks, and really for the first time since his dismissal over a year ago, Derek and I go deep into his time, his relatively short tenure in New York, his relationship with Phil Jackson, the triangle offense, the emergence of Kristaps Porzingis, Carmelo Anthony, the mistakes he thought he made as a young head coach, and what he thinks he can learn moving forward in his coaching career. I think it's a pretty illuminating visit with Derek Fisher. Here's our conversation. Derek, how are you, man?
I'm doing great, Walsh. How are you doing, man?
I'm good. You know, typical beautiful day, Southern California. You've lived a lot of these through the years. When you think about a kid growing up in Arkansas, playing 4 years at Arkansas Little Rock, getting drafted by the Lakers, what do you remember about getting on a plane in Arkansas and flying to LA and like not knowing what was ahead or not? Had you ever even been here before?
No, I had not been to California before. I had been to Seattle or right outside of Seattle for an AAU tournament when I was like 12 years old, but I had never been to California. So I only knew of it, the riots, the Rodney King incident, NWA, Ice Cube, like, you know, those visions, Snoop Dogg of the West Coast. So I had no idea what to expect. And so I'm on the plane and funny story, like I'm on the flight and I'm like, man, I was the first round pick of the Los Angeles Lakers. And all summer I've been hearing about, you know, Kobe and everything else, and people didn't even know I was on the Lakers. So I'm on the flight to LA and I'm literally thinking like, you know, should I like mention it to a flight attendant or somebody that, you know, I play for the Lakers?
Will they believe me?
Would they even understand what that means? But yeah, unbelievable, man, just to be on the way from Arkansas, Little Rock to LA to play for the Lakers.
You know, now for you, Derek, we talk about, you know, finishing as a player and then coaching with the Knicks. And you did something pretty rare, going literally from a playing career right into a head coaching job without a window of time there. The coaching life is certainly different from being a player, but the travel, how you fill your day is very different, but it's the same trips. And to now, for the first time in 21 years now, to have been out for a full year, where you don't have the structure anymore of an NBA season. You heard people talk about that, I'm sure, your whole career and how they adjust. But was it maybe more jarring than you imagine in terms of trying to figure out, just even now, what do I do?
Yeah, no, it was extremely jarring, in particular because it wasn't planned. You know, I think if, you know, after being fired by the Knicks unexpectedly, you know, all of these years of anticipating at some point, you know, basketball is not, you know, the main thing in terms of profession and control of your schedule. So, you know, all of those, you know, Players Association meetings and conferences and discussions about what are you going to do after basketball, all of a sudden it was right there, you know, last February, basically. And so, you know, here I am. You know, I immediately got on the plane and headed back to L.A. because I didn't think there was any upside to remaining in New York City for any minute longer after that. And so I got back here and, you know, just kind of immediately took a step back and just tried to figure a lot of things out. I mean, and I'm still, you know, kind of going through that process of, you know, I think for my children in particular, you know, being NBA children, you know, it's a different life. A lot of great things come with it.
They're also used to not having you around.
Yeah, a lot of perks. And then all of a sudden, I'm back in L.A. and I'm immediately trying to become more of a full-time dad. You know, more pickups and drop-offs at school, you know, more school activities, you know, being at everything that they're involved in. And, you know, that's a different life, and it's a bit of a struggle. And you know, some people are familiar with, you know, my relationship status and, you know, so all of a sudden, you know, I went from, you know, dating someone in a bi-coastal fashion to all of a sudden now we're, you know, face to face. And right. and so our relationship had to evolve because of that. So a lot of things changed immediately. There was no grace period to get to what the rest of my life could look like, you know, if I were not to be back in coaching or back in the front office, and, you know, which I'm hoping will happen one day. But all of a sudden, you know, basketball was temporarily gone.
When you got let go by the Knicks, you had started that year, and I think people forget this, you were 22-22 at one point, which was, yeah. you were in playoff contention, there was a market improvement, and then there was a losing streak of maybe 8-9, around 8-9 games, right?
Yeah, 1-9 over a 10-game stretch.
Were you surprised the day you got fired? Did you think it was coming?
No, I had a feeling that, you know, things were maybe getting a little, I don't know if restless is the word, but that you could feel a little bit of the tension building in terms of like, man, is it possibly, you know, another season that's going to get away from the team? But I did not expect to be fired that morning. We were going to meet that morning, you know, at 9 a.m., but I didn't know it was, you know, to be terminated. And, you know, considering during that stretch, you know, injuries to Melo, to Lance Thomas, you know, I think Kristaps was sick one or two games with the flu, and, you know, another one or two guys in or out. And, you know, for any team, you start taking out your best players for a couple games, things change. And so we just, you know, we had some close ones we couldn't get done. And, you know, the decision was made. But for sure, I was surprised. I was shocked. But, you know, I didn't tear the office up when they told me. I mean, I just thanked them for the opportunity and went to my office. And I called my parents. I called my girlfriend. And then I called my kids. And that was it.
When you look back on it, do you think you got let go at that time over results or alignment?
That's a good question. I mean, I would like to think more alignment than results. And that's the delicate balance in the league now is how to get alignment and reach alignment, you know, with differing philosophies in how to play basketball, how to coach basketball, you know, your roster composition and what actually can you do, even if you have visions of what you want to do, you know, do you have the roster to do those things? So, you know, I think looking back on it, it was probably more alignment, just, you know, not being able to find a more effective and efficient way to communicate with Phil and, you know, whatever part of it that I wasn't doing well enough or good enough for him to feel like the lines of communication were open or at least coming back to him. And also not having maybe full alignment in philosophy or trying to figure out how to get the best out of the players that we had at that time. And, you know, that's my job as a coach to try and find that alignment. And, you know, maybe I just, you know, I didn't do a good enough job from management's perspective. And that's a part of, you know, being a coach.
Was there any part of you that when you took the job and you talked about triangle in the process and you were well schooled in the triangle? I mean, Jeff Hornacek has never run it and he's had to learn it like the players would have to learn it, but you knew it. You played in it for a very long time. Was there any part of you that thought, okay, we're talking about the triangle now, but eventually I'll be able to move past it and run a system that I think fits the players? Or did you think, okay, this is what it's going to be? Or were you never sure exactly how it would play out?
Yeah, I didn't come into it thinking that Phil was going to demand, you know, that this is the only way that as the coach you can play, you know, with this team. You know, did I have a sense that that would be something we spent a lot of time talking about and maybe trying to make work and implement? For sure. But, you know, my impressions were that he was still going to give me the room to, you know, explore and figure out how to coach this team myself. Not meaning I can just free nearly do anything I wanted, but at the same time, you know, I wasn't necessarily executing his wishes. I think he really did intend for me to learn how to do some things on my own. And after talking a little bit, I wasn't completely averse to running the triangle, but I thought that there were some things that, you know, based on the way the game is played now compared to when we played and were running it and being successful and winning championships, mainly because of obviously Phil's brilliance, but also Kobe and Shaq and Pau Gasol and a lot of great players that I played with. I thought there were some things that we could do to take advantage of not just our personnel, but the way teams defend in the NBA, et cetera, that I wanted to do a little bit differently. And at times we were okay and we saw eye to eye, and at times we didn't.
When you came in, Derek, you had probably a better or a longer history with the GM than most coaches do going in a situation where they don't know the GM. You knew him, but you didn't know him in that role. You knew him as your coach, and he knew you as your player, but you didn't know how he'd be as a GM, and he maybe didn't know that if either one of you had ever had that particular job before, maybe it would have been easier. But the fact that both of you were trying something completely new, did that factor into this?
I have to believe that it did. You know, like you said, the fact that I had never been a head coach or assistant coach, you know, on an NBA team. You know, Phil hadn't been president of basketball operations in any other organization, although he clearly had decision-making power on some of the teams that mm-hmm. he coached. You know, he wasn't responsible for.
Yeah, it's not the same. You know, it's not running
the same
office thing. Yeah.
And that had to factor into it, I would think. I mean, I was even thinking about, you know, for Kurt Rambis and I, or Jim Clemens and I, like a lot of the things that were different. I mean, I played for Phil. You know, I played for Kurt as an interim head coach in 1999 during the lockout year for half of that season when Dale Harris got fired. He was also an assistant coach on some of the Lakers teams that I played for. Jim Clemens had been an assistant coach. And then all of a sudden, I'm the head coach, and those guys work, you know, with me and for me. And so I think there were a number of dynamics that with all of these new roles and, you know, the way we had to reform our relationships, you know, it was challenging for all of us. And I don't think anybody had bad intentions for anybody, but it was just a very delicate balance to try and keep together.
When you go from playing right into coaching, and listen, the things you always hear from the great coaches is, and you knew it as a player, you got to have relationships with your players to yeah. build trust. But then as a player, they're telling you, hey, don't act like a player. You've got to put a distance between you and them.
Right.
How did you manage that walking in? What do you know now that maybe you look back and said, I misread it or misjudged it, or I didn't trust my instincts? Or did you feel like you handled that the best you could?
Yeah, no, I think looking back on it, it's a great question. I agree that, you know, the relationships with your players as a coach and even as a player, you know, and teammates, like, is really key to any success that you want to have. And I feel like looking back on it, my first year, I overshot the mark trying to create separation between being a former player and now a coach. Because in playing for Phil and playing for Jerry Sloan, and playing for Scottie Brooks, that's probably who I had the closest relationship with as a player, was Scottie Brooks. We were close personally as well as player coach. But in playing for other coaches, there was sometimes that line and that boundary that you didn't get too close to the head coach. Maybe there were assistant coaches that you were closer to. And so I think I overshot the mark on – I didn't want the players in my first year, especially because I didn't know any of those guys personally very well, to think that I was still their peer as a player, that now I'm a head coach and I don't want to act like or carry myself like a player would at this point, like I need to be a coach. And I think that left some space and some distance between myself and some players that would have allowed us to be closer. And as we went through a lot of the ups and downs, you know, in my first year in particular, we probably could have weathered the storm a little bit more, you know, had I worked harder to be closer and develop more personal relationships with the guys, at least to the best of my ability.
You had to have known Melo. You must have had some kind of relationship with Melo before because, you know, he was, you know, through Players Association, you're close with Kobe, and Kobe and Melo had a relationship. Where were you two when you walked in the door there?
Yeah, Melo and I were in places and still in places of respect and appreciation for each other's like accomplishments. I always felt like Melo respected me and what I had been able to do as a player in terms of my career. I think he respected the fact that I was not just thrown this opportunity, that I actually could figure it out and become really good at it. And I felt the same way about him. But we hadn't been on the same team before. You know, honestly, we weren't anybody's friends in the Western Conference for right. many years. And I wasn't the buddy-buddy type of guy as a player. Like, I really wasn't friendly with a lot of guys that I played against over the years. Wasn't bad, but...
Even if you wanted to be, Kobe didn't allow that in the Laker culture in those years.
Yeah, but I didn't... That wasn't me either.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Kobe and I's relationship as kind of co-leaders worked really well, because the standard was set
right.
for the rest of the guys that, we're here to wipe out the competition, not to befriend them.
The beginning of last season, in the preseason, Derek, you know, the trip to California during training camp at the end of the two-a-days, and you had a break over a weekend. You went home to California. I think you practiced on a Saturday morning, and your plan was to do what?
My plan, which, man, looking back on it, it was all
a
blur. Yeah,
it
definitely went awry. Yeah. My plan was on Sunday. My plan was to fly back to L.A. on Saturday night, get back Saturday night. And on Sunday, I'd arranged to see my twins, who are now 10. I guess they were 9 at the time, to spend the day with them on Sunday. I had been through, my ex-wife and I had gone through divorce. So we were divorced. My kids and she had moved back to California towards the end of the previous season. So I got a chance to spend a ton of time with them over the off season. But, early September, once everybody's back in the facilities and coaches are back on campus and getting after it, I hadn't seen as much of them as I had over the summer. So that Sunday, I was scheduled to spend the entire day with my kids on Sunday and then take a red eye flight. Which is crazy. I made arrangements for a private plane on Sunday night to get back to New York Monday morning to almost ensure that because you can't control weather, but that there weren't like airline delays for any unforeseen reasons. So looking back on it, I don't regret coming back to California to see my kids on Sunday, but I should not have put myself in a position where what happened that Saturday night happened. And as a coach, if a player had come to me and said, hey, coach, I want to go spend a day with my kids. They live in Florida or Chicago or whatever. As long as he was back at practice on Monday, right. I would have supported that. And then obviously if I read about him, something happening on Saturday night, I would have been, disappointed. As well. So, looking back on it from that perspective, man, I hate that I put myself in a position where I became the focal point instead of all the focus remaining on these players and our mission this season and the fact that, we're going to be a better team. The conversation kind of started right away about what was the coach doing, and I regret that.
This perception that became out of your girlfriend, Gloria, and the ex-wife of Matt Barnes, that became this thing that took on a life of its own that some players would have thought you violated a code that players aren't supposed to violate. And therefore, you had lost the respect with players. Or you had lost something in the locker room. That was sort of the narrative out there. When you came back to the team in the aftermath of that, and it became a story that nobody wants to be involved in, nobody wants to have to answer to, especially as a coach, but you had to deal with it. What did you find when you came back and with your team in the locker room? Had something changed? Did you feel like the team was playing 500 ball through the All-Star break, 44 games in, which was a marked improvement. It's hard to say guys weren't responding, that they weren't playing. What changed after that?
Honestly, I think that guys were compassionate and sympathetic. I do think that in my first year, the guys that we had returning, they knew enough of me to know that I wasn't a bad person, that whatever did happen from maybe what they were reading or hearing wasn't maybe, you know, as terrible as it sounds, because we're with this guy every day. So this doesn't seem like something he would, you know, get himself into. And what I found was, I thought guys were respectful. They didn't pry. A few guys, you know, really were just checking to make sure I was okay. And we went back to work. I mean, I tried my best to be the example that I would want them to be if they were in a situation that was difficult for them, that they wouldn't run from the media or, you know, feel like the team didn't care about them. They would still just focus on their job and doing, you know, focusing on the things they could control, basically. Right. And so I didn't feel that guys had given up on me because of that situation. I think they understood that we're all human for the most part.
Do you think, whether it was ownership, management, the organization, do you think they looked at you differently after that?
It's possible. I mean, yeah. You know, they for sure, you know, can answer that themselves, but it's possible. And I could understand, you know, why just on appearance,
right,
you would be viewed differently. And so, you know, like I said, the hindsight's always 20/20, and you always know better after. I mean, it's kind of like golf when you take your practice swing, or like the swing after you lose the first ball and then swing at the other one. You know better, but it's possible, yeah, that I was viewed differently.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Derek, give me a minute to tell my listeners about ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the very best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Woj, W-O-J. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Woj. Now back to my guest, Derek Fisher. With Kristaps Porzingis and what he did out of the gate as a rookie, what you saw and had in him, was there a thought in your mind that I've got this player that I can build around that can be our cornerstone? The Knicks haven't had that guy, homegrown guy, really like that since Patrick Ewing. You know, mm-hmm. I think that kind of a player. When you started to realize what he could be and how maybe what surprised everybody was how quickly it came. I think people thought it might take longer.
Yeah.
Did you think, hey, I'm going to be attached to Kristaps. We're going to develop him and grow, and this is a guy that I could be with a long time. Did he get, because it's very rare that players like him don't come along with any organization.
No, too often. Not very often. Not as good as he is, you know, in terms of physically what he can do on the court, but also, you know, what's most impressive about Chris is just his mind. He's a laser-focused young guy and takes his job very seriously, and he comes to work every single day ready to get after it. And so there was no doubt that he was going to be good. I mean, he was doing things in training camp that, you know, I hadn't seen a player of his size and sometimes any size do so easily and so fluid. So, you know, I didn't automatically think, okay, well, you know, here's my guy of the future, so let me get closer to him because he's the future and Melo's the now, or, you know, Aaron Aflalo's the now, or what, like. But it was just a genuine appreciation for this young guy's going to help us win a lot of games this year,
right,
you know, and hopefully for years to come. I mean, he was is that impressive.
I was with him the first day he came to New York, and we met and we went to lunch that day. And listen, you know, you meet a lot of 18, 19-year-old kids, and whether they're from around the world or domestically, you don't always know what you're going to get, the maturity. And I remember just walking away, and he had said to me that day, like, they all think I'm going to be – I'm Darko. I'm this. He said, like, they don't know how important this is to me. Like, the people who think I'm going to be a bust, they've never seen me play. He was so – he wanted to get that message out. He goes, I know what they think of me here or what the perception is. And it's rare you see that. I remember I asked them, like, the question was, like, what's the one thing you think about when you look at the NBA and being here and living in the States that you don't have access to now playing in Spain that you're going to have here? And I didn't know what it was going to be, like, 24-hour takeout, you know, whatever. He said that I can get in the gym whenever I want. I remember he said, he goes, in Spain, like, if I want to go shoot on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock, I have trouble getting in that gym. I know here that whenever you want to get in the gym, someone will let you in to play. I haven't heard that always from – that's not what – but it spoke to who he was. And that's what I think with him. And you saw it firsthand of just – when you have that kind of talent with that kind of drive, that's what makes him unique.
No, that's definitely what makes him unique. And it's I think it's always surprising to people when that's not the norm or the standard for all players.
But
I think
isn't.
We all assume that every, you know, professional athlete, NBA player is talent combined with this amazing, you know, mental fortitude and, you know, laser focus, and we're all different. And that doesn't mean the guys that aren't built a certain way are quote unquote weak or, you know, can't be great. But it's just different. And to me, Chris had that combination that you need to not just play well in the NBA or be good, but to be great. And in particular, when you're getting drafted into a situation like New York City, you know, where he wanted to embrace and did embrace that all the challenges and everything that comes with that, the pressure, the expectations, the intense, crazy fans. Like, he was not afraid of any of that. I mean, everybody was disappointed when we won two games late in that season prior to drafting Kristaps and thought that, you know, our lottery ball chances were
– can't get Okafor anymore.
Ruined.
Right.
Because, you know, we're not going to maybe get the first pick. And so, you know, he's – basically drafted on draft night and booed because nobody's really familiar with who he is and what he could do. And this guy has walked right into it, you know, face first, chest out, and broken through it all. And I think that tells you all you need to know.
Was it always interesting with him? Because when people haven't seen anything like that, they want to think, well, it can't be. Like, we haven't seen a 7'3 guy who handles the ball, who can put the ball on the floor and go by you, never mind – all the things he can do, and you go, oh, geez, he'll break, right? He'll break down. His body won't. When you first saw him, and you, I think we were in the gym the same day in Vegas at his agent workout, and, you know, it was just there. You were just seeing him, you know, shooting, and, like, they're never going to put him in a situation where they're not going to look pretty good. But you watch tape, and even the tape in Spain, though, didn't – he wasn't killing the Spanish ACB League the year before. He hadn't put up big numbers, but – when you first saw him and you were imagining him in the league, did it seem, geez, there's no one really like him, so are our eyes deceiving us? Like, what was your first thought with him?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the two parts of it. The tape part, what was impressive on tape was his defensive ability and the way he reacted to the ball on defense. You could see that on tape. What kind of offensive player he could be, you know, we heard a lot about him being able to shoot and all those things, but you know, like you said, it wasn't that he statistically was just killing it and there was a bunch of tape on him getting 30 points every night. So seeing him in Vegas that day at his pro day, that confirmed for me that, like, this kid can really shoot the basketball. Like, this is not a rumor. It's not pretending. You know, it's not hype. He can flat out shoot. And somebody his size with his length, that's impressive. And then they started to do, you know, other drills. Like you said, they're not going to put their guys in a – too much of a position to fail, but you can still pick up on certain things and physically how easily he ran the floor, how comfortable he was with the basketball in his hands. And so I felt a lot more comfortable with the direction that we were all starting to think that this is going to be our guy. Like, after seeing him in person, we had talked about it before, but seeing him in Vegas that day gave me some comfort that he can handle the transition in terms of what I've seen in his game.
Derek, having the year and a half as a Knicks head coach, you sort of go back to square one of, okay, what do I want to do? I mean, you're doing TV now. I remember as a player, I think there was a time you thought more front office than coaching as a player when you looked out that was an interest. But when you got let go in New York and you started, and I started to hear a little bit that you were working out and you were thinking of playing again, was there a part of you that thought you thought you still could play, or you thought, I just want to play? Where was your head when all of a sudden you were, I'm going to get back in the gym and see if I can do this at 40 plus years old? Because even before you took the Knicks job, Oklahoma City would have re-signed you again. It wasn't like you went into coaching because you were out of jobs in the NBA as a player, right?
You
could have played at least another year.
Correct.
Is that was your thought at the time? Well, if I could still do it 2 years ago, maybe I still have it in me now?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know if I went back into the gym with the goal of playing again on a team and like, you know, this all ending that way. It was as much about, and I remember talking to, you know, the Gloria and some people closest to me that it was as much about the challenge and the process of taking yourself through things that are uncomfortable and hard and maybe seems impossible, but I needed to prove to myself again that I was willing to work really hard at something, and I didn't have, you know, an outlet at that time other than that to put it into. And I've always been most comfortable on a court, in a gym, you know, playing basketball, talking the game, being around other people that love basketball. And so I needed to do that and just feel what working hard at it again felt like. But I really didn't feel like it had to end in...
It didn't necessarily have to be a means to an end at that point.
No, it really didn't. I think the means to the end was the process of it and just kind of going through that again. It was healthy for me. And I've always just felt better when I'm in great shape anyway.
Right.
And, you know, as a coach, I wasn't in the best shape that I had been in, you know, in terms of being a player. Like, I wasn't training as much. I used to, you know, I feel like if I'm working out for an hour and a half, I just lost an hour and a half of, you know, watching film, doing this, going over some plays, you know, other things that I could be doing to help these guys. Who cares if I'm in shape? Like, let me go do something to help my players out. So I wanted to get back in good shape too, because I just always felt like I thought better, I felt better. You know, my creativity and innovation and all these things are just better when I'm in great shape.
Listen, the opportunity to become the Knicks coach came when it came. And listen, there's assistants in the league who've been assistants for 20, 25 years, never get an offer. Your opportunity came. It was in New York, and there were lots of reasons to embrace it and finish your playing career and go to it. So you took it. Is there a part of you now you say, okay, would it have made a difference if I was an assistant coach? Is there something – because now if you're going to coach more, you're going to be an assistant somewhere if you do it in the NBA initially. Mm-hmm. Did you lose out on anything, do you think, in the process of just making that jump? Or do you think that, like, if the circumstances were aligned right, you were equipped, you were ready? Because sometimes you don't know if you're ready to do it till after.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a great question. I don't think anything fully prepares you for being a head coach. I do think, of course, that being an assistant coach and, you know, having a real good feel for, you know, if you were the coach, how you would want to play, what you would want to do, you know, being around guys, seeing, you know, how delicate it is in terms of relationship building. And you're kind of getting this, like, this daily repetition at becoming a head coach one day. So I don't think you ever, like, should pass that up. Like, right. If I had a great opportunity to do that right now, I would do it. But then I think, again, until you get into that main seat as the head coach, you really have no full clue what it feels like and what that's like. And so I don't regret taking advantage of the opportunity that was there at the time. I think I learned a lot from it. I do think when I do get another opportunity to coach, I'll be better for it because of that experience. And And then if I am a head coach again at some point, that experience will be, you know, tremendously helpful. So I don't really, you know, see it as a negative. I mean, I, like you said, there are people that are still working extremely hard that haven't gotten that opportunity yet.
Right.
I mean, I could think of some great coaches that just haven't even gotten a chance yet. So, you know, they would have taken it as well. Every guy in the world, I think, would at least have considered, you know, taking that head coaching job at that time.
Between now and you getting a job that might appeal to you in the league, whether it's an assistant coaching job or in the NBA or wherever, what do you think there are things that people in the league want to see from you or you sense are questions about you that you've got to answer?
I mean, I try not to speak for other people. I'm not certain exactly what those things would be, but I think when all you have on your resume is a year and a half, you know, and as a head coach or assistant coach or whatever, and that's all they have to go on, you know, I was in a sense, I was running an offense that I didn't create or, you know, bring to the table. I was trying my best to implement it, you know, in the best way I could, but that wasn't my design. So I think there are a number.
But you get judged on it, though, right?
Of course.
Yeah, you're judged on it, right?
It's your team. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, right. You're the coach. So, yeah, not because I'm pushing that off on someone else. More, I'm saying that from the standpoint of if I'm a president of a team or an owner of a team and you're evaluating me
now. They've got to take that into consideration.
They have to, you know, like more so I'm just saying that I need to be able to put myself in position to show people me and not me in the context of someone else's design or mm-hmm. someone else's team or someone like see me working, see me in the gym, you know, see how I, you know, can develop great relationships with players, you know, see how much I love the game. And then, you know, maybe there's a fit,
right,
you know, within their organization for what it is that I could bring in. But I do think it would be hard for some teams now, and especially if there isn't anybody there that knows me personally.
Right.
And understands me more than just what people saw in New York. You know, I think, of course, there has to be some other maybe evaluation process that needs to take place to really see if I can do this.
And I think sometimes, too, like what they'll hold against you as an ex-player is, so you went from, you know, playing to a big-time job. It's the Knicks. Well, who doesn't want to coach when it's the Garden and it's a five-year deal and – do you want to coach, like, do you want to be in the gym in the summer? Where, you know, they go, do you want the lifestyle or do you love the craft, right?
Yeah.
And that's probably, you know, if people doubt that, does he love the craft of it?
No,
because you just, you know, and I think Doc Rivers used to make this point when people, when Doc made the jump, they said, okay, people are saying you didn't pay your dues, but his point was, hey, we were playing while these other guys were coaching. We were breaking down film and working closely with the coach. We were playing while right. they were
right.
assistants, guys who didn't play. It wasn't like we weren't at the beach.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that's, I mean, I've had that same conversation with Doc, and he's always been very generous, with his time, you know, whenever we've spoken. And he said the same thing, like, don't apologize for having played so long, you know, before getting this opportunity. And so, no, I think, you know, I understand why coaches that have been after it for a long time and haven't gotten that opportunity would feel that way, though. I mean, that's any of us, no matter what profession we're in. If we've been getting after it for 5 years, 10 years, 7 years, and we haven't gotten that chance, but a guy that hasn't, quote-unquote, put that work in gets that opportunity, I would feel a certain type of way as well. But I don't think you know, can sum up a person's abilities just on that. And so, you know, to I think both of our points, like, just you do the best you can with where you are at that time. And I don't, you know, regret it. And I think that coaches that I've worked with or that know me personally, at least, you know, I think overall it was a positive. I don't think people, and oh no, that's what I want to go back to. I know it was as a player, but still basketball, right? And if you don't completely love and adore the game of basketball, the craft of being great at it, you don't do what it is that me and the teams that I played on were able to do. It's impossible. You can't fake that. And then as a coach, you know, you don't take on that challenge and you run from the next job if you don't love this craft and this opportunity. The lifestyle for me is, I've gotten accustomed to it because it's been 20 years, but I played basketball because I loved it, and I coached basketball because I love basketball. So, you know, if, like I said, if I'm in that position again, no matter what the role is, you know, the game of basketball will always have, you know, me wrapped around his finger.
You know, it's funny. You mentioned that your closest relationship as a coach was with Scotty Brooks. Now, your careers were different. You were a more established player, a better player than Scotty was. But I do think there's something, you know, people sometimes wonder about the great player having the patience to coach, because the guy who was a superstar player, now Larry Bird had success, he had good teams, and, you know, we could go through the list of guys who were great, great players. You know, Jerry West, I mean, Jerry, I'm sure you probably had that conversation with him around the Lakers. Jerry just, it was hard for him to, he was better in the front office, and he had a very good run as a coach, but whether it's patience or being able to identify, like, Larry Bird's never been the last guy at the end of the bench. You've played a lot of different roles. Even a guy like Scott Brooks, who knows what it's like to be at the end. He knows what it's like to play. Your career was a little more well-rounded, but you kind of do fit the mold more of the players who've had success because, I don't know, maybe you can see the game or see the perspective from more areas than just a guy who was just better than everybody else and maybe has a harder time understanding why guys can't do the things that I could do.
Yeah. No, I do think there's some validity to having that perspective. Doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, I think that if Kobe Bryant wanted to coach, he could probably be a really, really good coach. He might not want to do it long, the same way Larry Bird specifically chose not to do it long because
see, it was I always thought with, you know what, Kobe, if and I don't, I doubt he ever will.
No, I'm not saying
right,
he
but,
will.
But in the, I always thought if Kobe wanted to be a GM, because Kobe likes so much a part of being a GM is watching tape. I could see Kobe having the patience, if he wanted to, of studying tape on players, of doing the long work, more so than maybe the day-to-day of, I think it would be a hard day-to-day for him to be on the bench. But being a GM is a lot of isolation.
Yeah,
it's a lot of alone. And Kobe, that's Kobe, right? I just thought if that's what he ever wanted to do, it fit what some of his strengths are, fits his personality.
Yeah,
better.
No, that's a good point. I mean, I was just speaking to the idea that I think guys that, as great as he was as a player, when you have the ability mentally to do what he was able to do, you can do anything if you want to do it.
Right, so, right.
But I agree that there is validity to I think being able to relate to other people's journey and process and struggles and triumphs and all those things are to me important about all relationships. And so as a player, you know, all the way back even as a kid, like I was very rarely the best player on any of my teams. Maybe the first team I was ever on when I was 6 years old, but I've always had to figure out how to mend and blend my abilities and strengths and weaknesses with the other guys around me. And, you know, that's what I tried to do as a coach, you know, in terms of trying to put a staff together of different strengths and weaknesses. And I specifically didn't want all coaches that had run only the triangle before, because I thought it was important that in our coaches meetings, we had the perspective of coaches that hadn't been in this before. How would you defend it? You know, what would you do to improve it? Those are things that were important to me. And I think that's important to being a good coach, is being able to kind of at least try to relate to what all of your guys are going through. And night in and night out, you know, especially that first year when we were struggling to win a game one time in a month sometimes, my main message to every player in that locker room was don't just get tunnel vision and think about how bad this feels for you. Think about the guy next to you and what he's going through. Think about how if you played 18 minutes tonight, he played 4 minutes tonight. If you played 4 minutes tonight, he played no minutes tonight. And if everybody can, like, put ourselves one seat over and think about what it's like for him, you know, sometimes it just helps us kind of get through tough times.
What was it like to stand in Madison Square Garden? And, you know, people can say they don't hear what people are yelling. You hear it. There's a quiet. There's a lull. When it's going like that and you're standing there and you're standing there alone, right? And you, as a player, you can impact some things on the floor. You can say, I'm going to check in the game and I can impact. I'm going to go whatever it is. It's harder to do that as a coach. What was that feeling like? Is it what you imagined? Was it different than anything you ever feel as a player? Because you really, as much as coaches want to believe they can control, you can't, right?
No. I mean, as far as just all of the different things that are completely out of your control, it is mind-blowing. You know, you can't completely control your players. You can't control the officials. You can't control the opponent's coaches, what they're going to run, what they're going to do. And that's probably what drives every coach crazy, is that you can't really control it, although you're not sleeping and, you know, doing insane things to try to figure out how to control more variables. And, you know, and so that was the fun part for me, though, was making that transition from, as a player, you know, you were trying to figure out variables that you could control, but for the most part, your variables and what you could do to impact the game to help the team win. So to all of a sudden be in a position where you're trying to figure out all of these variables for everybody, you know, on the team, that was, you know, completely different. But that was a part of embracing the challenge of accepting the job, was that and loving that part of the craft, like really trying to figure all of this out to be the best that we could be and really to help guys be the best versions of themselves. I mean, that's ultimately what we're all trying to do. And, you know, sometimes we had moments where it looked like we were going that direction and, you know, there were some nights where we didn't, but I thought doing it at the Garden was, you know, one of the best feelings that you could ever have. I mean, the fans, although they can be tough and rough, most nights, if not every night, they always came in there ready to give us everything. And the only time they didn't is when they felt like we didn't give it everything. And, you know, I wish that there could have been more nights where they felt like we really did give it all. And I think there were. You know, there were just a lot of nights where we just weren't the best team on the floor, even though we were trying our hardest.
Fish, I appreciate you doing this, man.
Oh, yeah. Nah, I appreciate it, Woj. You know, I know, you know, what people think, I guess, are on opposite sides, or, you know, media player, media coach. But I've always had a lot of respect for what you do and what your guys do. It's hard to put a voice on something that maybe you're not in it, but you're giving your best, the best version, the best perspective, and, you know, the way you guys have to nurture relationships in order to really be good at this is really key. So I appreciate the opportunity, man. A lot of people maybe don't want to hear anything I have to say right this way, so I appreciate you giving me this chance, man.
I appreciate it, Fish. Thanks, sir.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. A big thank you to my guest today, Derek Fisher. Remember, you can subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes of this podcast and the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, and you can hear us on the Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our sponsor today, ZipRecruiter. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. We'll catch you next time.